The Tom Woods Show, episode 645.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you enjoy this show, you're really going to like the free course I've made available to you on the real history of the U.S. presidents. Very, very helpful, especially during an election year. Check it out at freehistorycourse.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. We've got a really interesting topic for discussion today, but because it's a long episode, but you're not going to want to turn it off, I guarantee you, I do want to make a little announcement toward the beginning. That is, I'm going to be speaking in Seattle and in Orlando and in the coming months in Boston as well, and I will have links to information about those events over at TomWoods.com on the events page. You can just go to TomWoods.com/events. The other thing is, remember we had Chris Guillebeau on a couple of weeks ago for his book Born for This? It's a book about how to find the work you were meant to do. It was a great conversation. Everybody loved it. He's a great, really smart guy to talk to. He's doing his own book tour for that book, and I'm going to be in the Denver area when he's going to be in Denver this a week from Friday. It's going to be April 29th, 2016. It's in Denver at the Tattered Cover Bookstore, and it'll be starting at 7 p.m. Well, I'm going to go because I think Chris is fascinating to listen to, and plus, just from an entrepreneur angle, I want to watch how he does this. Because it's not just a lecture. He has audience participation, and he self-funds these book tours of his. I want to watch a master like this in action. I think it's going to be a lot of fun, and I'm actually bringing a friend who I think could benefit from what Chris has to say. So if you're in the Denver area and you happen to see me in the audience, say hello. But definitely go to bornforthisbook.com and find the Denver event, and or you know anywhere around the country that you'd like to attend, and make sure an RSVP for it. And I hope to see you there. Okay, now let's get on to the subject for today. Very unusual kind of topic for us, but in a way it's not, in that it's overthrowing a conventional view, and it's a view that I believed for a long time. We're talking about Ngo Dinh Diem, who was the Vietnamese leader who was overthrown, you'll recall, in 1963 with the connivance of the Kennedy administration. And that ushered in a series of, you know, just one military ruler after another and brought about a tremendous chaos in South Vietnam. And according to the author of the book we're going to be talking about today, The Lost Mandate of Heaven, this is what set in motion the series of events that led to all the major U.S. military intervention there. And he's more or less arguing that if you hadn't gotten rid of Diem, this would not have been necessary. So how is and also the standard narrative is Diem was a corrupt leader, so Kennedy had no choice but to get rid of him and all that. That narrative, it turns out, is not quite right. And it's something that, as I say, I myself taught for years when I was at teaching college kids. And I looked at this book and I realized that the situation is a lot more complicated. It's not this angels and devils story that we're led to believe about. There's a lot of stuff that's BS about the standard narrative of what went on, and particularly the standard narrative surrounding Diem himself. So the book is called The Lost Mandate of Heaven. We'll be linking to it at tomwoods.com/645. And our guest is the author, Jeffrey Shaw, who has been a professor of history at the American Military University. He has a doctorate in history from the University of Manitoba, and he is president of the Alexandrian Defense Group, which is a think tank on counterinsurgency warfare. Professor Shaw, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks. It's good to be here.
I just told people about your book, The Lost Mandate of Heaven, and the basic thesis of it. It really is... it's a stunning book, and in a way, the thesis of it is summed up in a line on page 18 that really struck me. You wrote, "In order to solve a problem that did not exist, the Kennedy administration created a problem that could not be solved." That's devastating. That's beautiful. When you come up with a line like that, you got to be dancing a jig. That's perfect. It encapsulates what you're saying in just a beautiful way. But if I were to throw that out at you, then we would be diving too deeply into the book. I want to start off. I want to have you introduce Diem to the audience. What's his background, and how does it happen that there's a point in U.S. history in the 1950s in which most arguably, of the American establishment is very much behind him.
Okay. Well, his background is this. He came from a well-established Mandarin family in the imperial city of Wei. They were ministers who served the emperor in Vietnam. And basically, it was a Roman Catholic family that had been, I think they'd converted just before the father, who was Nodin Ka. And but they'd witnessed persecutions. It's ironic that we often think of, when we think of Vietnam, the Buddhist, alleged Buddhist persecution, when in fact there had been many very real persecutions of the Roman Catholics who'd been killed and everything taken and stolen from them. Anyway, so he came from that background. And at a very young age, he's well-educated. His father insisted on good education for the whole family. And at a very young age of mid-20s, he was managing a number of villages in smaller villages, which encompassed a bigger village in Vietnam. And he did so well at it, he came to the attention of not just the Vietnamese leaders, but also the colonial masters, the French, who from that point on started to offer him jobs within the Vietnamese indigenous indigenous government. He excelled at that, and he was well respected by basically many of the farmers and local people, because he knew so much about agriculture, how to get the best rice crops, how to get the best fish ponds built, the things that were very important to the ordinary Vietnamese. So he was honored and revered at that level. So he excelled. We're talking mid-20s. And then he became basically the minister of a whole province under the Vietnamese/French government, and continued to excel at that and be widely respected as both a fair, just, and incorrupt ruler. And also, this bought him enormous non-communist nationalist credentials. And this is very important, because eventually the communists took over what was the National Front for all organizations that objected to French rule, and just subsumed them unto themselves, and everything then became communist. But they tried to claim that no, it was a popular National Front, as they generally do. So he'd garnered these credentials through hard work and diligence and capability, and especially what's important, what we call this mandate of heaven in the Confucian sense, is it was a moral capability and a moral authority, which was very, very important to the Vietnamese. It was more important than, say, being really good at giving political speeches and glad-handing and smacking people on the back and big smiles and kissing babies. That didn't mean anything to them. What was important to them was the moral authority of the leader. He had to live his life by example. Anyways, he also had aspired at one time or another to be a priest. He had studied very diligently to be within Roman Catholic schooling to acquire those credentials. And he also had a hankering to be a monk. So his first calling that seemed to be towards the religious life, but again, because of the Confucian ethic, he saw it as his moral obligation to help his country out in a time in need. And this became especially so in the immediate post 1945 era, when basically all heck was breaking loose in all these emerging countries, and the communists were riding that wave and taking over many of the local objections to the remaining of colonial rule. So he goes on from there and actually becomes a prime minister under the essentially puppet Emperor Bao Dai. But before all this happens, of course, he has encounters with the communists. Ho Chi Minh himself had him captured and tried to win him over to being with their conglomerate of parties, which was really just the Communist Party. And he refused. And Ho Chi Minh was so enamored with the man's capabilities as a Vietnamese leader and just that moral authority, he wouldn't kill him. He let him go. Later, various communists said that was a mistake. They should have killed him. But he also had run into trouble with the French because of his strong nationalist standings. And they had jailed him a couple of times. They'd stripped him of all the awards and medals he had won. And then they found out they couldn't get by without him. The Vietnamese wouldn't respond to anybody but Diem. So they'd take him out of isolation, give him his awards and medals back. And then, of course, he would just carry on being Diem, which was just a totally honest and frank nationalist Vietnamese who didn't want much to do with the colonial power anymore. Nor had he ever, I should add. So we move on to the point where there's death threats now from various communists, he moves off on a world tour. He actually has an audience with the Pope, and he meets the Vietnamese in Paris, and then he's in the United States for quite a while, many months, and he takes up residence at the Mary Knowles Seminary in upstate New York, where he met men like Mike Mansfield, and Senator Mike Mansfield, very, very powerful senator, Cardinal Francis Spellman, and young Massachusetts Senator JFK, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And they were all mightily impressed with them. And one of the things that impressed them the most was the fact that they'd go to meet him take him out to go to a meeting. And he would be scrubbing the floors in the seminary, taking out the garbage, doing all the mundane things. And they would see this as, well, you know, how can a big leader of a country be like this? But that was precisely what the Vietnamese honored in him so much, was his absolute humility that way. So essentially, many American histories have written that it was the Americans that sought him out for the very troubled Vietnam, especially in post-Dien Bien Phu, 1954, and the collapse of the French effort there. And I should say it was a political collapse, not a military collapse, because three-quarters of the French forces in Indochina were undefeated after the fall of Dien Bien Phu, but there was no will at home to continue. France was in an uproar over Vietnam, an uproar over many things. He was in the States, and he sought out these gentlemen and was advised to do so by his brothers and by others to get American support, because he thought that would be the best way to go forward for a non-communist nationalist Vietnam. And the Americans absolutely loved what they saw in the man, this incorruptible, humble man. So 55, he does become president, and there's some trouble with some sects, and there are people like the Binh Duan, which were a river pirate organization, but these sects had very powerful armies that belonged to him, so he had quite a challenge from the beginning, and the French were, of course, supporting the sects, and even at that time, the American advice was, well, why don't you go along with them? But he said, how can I be the leader of Vietnam and go along with a sect that essentially has bought the police concession in Saigon, Cholon, and at the same time is running the biggest opium dens and prostitution network in all of Southeast Asia? And they had no answer to that, but he did. So he did eventually undermine and destroy those, and basically a clash of arms that the French stood back, and even the Americans, as early as 55, they stood back from that clash too, not sure if they should support him through that. So we go through the 50s, and he's basically rebuilding a ruined country, and very important, in the rebuilding, because of his Confucian understanding of history and the place and the power of it in the Vietnamese mind, he recognized that Buddhism itself was totally in total collapse and disarray and utterly dilapidated of any physical infrastructure. So basically, he became the single most important person in rebuilding historical Buddhism in Vietnam in the post-45 era. Really, that should be the pre-45 era, too, because it had been collapsed for some time under the French colonialism. Because not that he was a Buddhist, he was a devout Roman Catholic. And by the way, a devout Roman Catholic who was up for Mass every morning at 6:30. It was that he saw it as part of the Vietnamese culture and history. And he also saw it at least as a partial answer to those who were looking for a new direction after with the removal of the colonial authority, and we didn't want them wandering into the lands of the communist ideology, that is. So we get through the 50s, and by the end of the 50s, Vietnam has been so miraculously recovered under Ngo Dinh Diem, along with a lot of American aid and help, which was very good. And they had actually were building schools, roads, everything, even rudimentary healthcare in the districts, in the rural districts, to the point where the communist leadership in the north had a meeting in 59 and said, if it goes on like this, the whole thing is going to collapse. We will have no chance of winning back South Vietnam. Incidentally, there had been in the Geneva Accords that were signed with the French and post Dien Bien Phu by 1955, that by 1956, the country, which had basically been artificially dissected as North and South Vietnam, would have elections.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about this because this is another of the conventional points of the conventional wisdom, isn't it? That in 1956, the reunification election was supposed to be held.
Yeah.
It was not held. The South did not consent to it. And the argument is that's because they knew that the wildly popular communist leader, Ho Chi Minh, would have been overwhelmingly successful. And the U.S. backed Diem in refusing to consent to the elections. What do you think of that explanation?
Well, it is the standard explanation, but it is it just does not the kindest thing I can say is it just doesn't mesh with the reality and the facts. Here are the facts. By 1956, like all communist governments, just previous to that, Ho Chi Minh and his cronies up in the north thought, well, we have to have land reform. And they started land reform, and under communist rule, land reform is really a euphemism for bashing the peasants. Any land-owning farmer, be he large or small, declaring them all landlords, wicked landlords, and essentially robbing them of their property, and then reforming state collectives. It always goes violent and terribly wrong, where you have a fellow farmer who's vindictive or has an axe to grind against another farmer, declaring to the authority he's a landlord and he's robbing the peasants, and so he and his family get murdered, and the land goes sometimes to the other fellow who then becomes in charge of the collective. So a lot of this was going on. We know that at least 10,000 Vietnamese had been slaughtered. They had to call in several regiments to enact their land reform in various regions in North Vietnam. And in so doing, of course, a lot of peasants were murdered. So then what was determined as also part of the 1956 accords was, what was to happen in 1956 before the vote was, okay, all people in the South who want to go north can go north, and all people in the north can go south. Well, no one went north, but pretty well over a million went south. Yes, many of them were Roman Catholics, but there were many others too. They fled the north with nothing.
You see, I've heard the left explain this away, that this was right-wing propaganda that scared people into leaving.
No, what scared them into leaving was all the murder and mayhem going on with the land reform, who eventually...
That would be my view.
Yeah, who even the communists eventually said, oh, we made mistakes. That's a euphemism when the communists say they've made a mistake, that too many people got murdered and it made too big a noise. But anyways, so these folks, they flee south. Now, many of them left with the shirts on their back and they had nothing. And here we have President Diem in his palace in Saigon. Incidentally, he does not live an ostentatious life. By people who knew him and who I've talked to, he lived in his office. He slept on a cot, ate fish and rice. He would have nothing to do with the rich man's life, which just wasn't part of his nature. And when people would come to him and say, we've got all these people looking for help and they've got nothing. He would empty his own pockets, his own bank account. He gave himself away to these people. And it stunned all those who knew him, of course, causing even greater reverence. I mean, how many politicians do you know would give up their salary to other people? But he did it. And so these people came down south, and around about 800,000 to 900,000 of them were Roman Catholics. But and people go, well, you know, there you have the sort of the building of a Roman Catholic state and oligarchy. But you have to remember, the strength of the Roman Catholics was first they had this faith that was absolutely powerful against communism. It gave them a rock hard anchor and fortress against it. Also, they were by far and away the best educated. But regardless of that, Ziem was still mindful to include Buddhists wherever he could. And as General Nguyen Khan told me, he said, well, look, I'm a Buddhist, and I was, you know, one of his favorite generals. His cabinet was three quarters Buddhist. So there were these objections that somehow he was building a Roman Catholic state to the exclusion of all else. They're just not founded in reality. Neither were the 1956 Accords. The communists went quiet on it. And as Edward Gary Lansdale said, and he predicted this, he said, the communists will let it drop. You watch. They won't make a sound about it because they know that if they had elections, they would lose mightily right now because of the bloody mayhem that had gone on in the land reform. And it was that pretty well that straightforward. So the 56 elections were actually dropped by both sides with a little bit of noise from the Communist Party blaming the South, and the South not really responding because they knew the truth. Everybody who had fled the North knew the truth. Again, to underscore for your listeners, no one fled to the communists, but pretty near and maybe over, we're not too sure, over 1 million people fled from them. So that should tell you just who was popular and who wasn't.
Now, by the way, that's exactly the answer that Nixon gives in his book, No More Vietnams, that he wrote in the 80s, looking back on the experience. And I think people are not inclined to believe it because it's coming out of Nixon's mouth. But just because Nixon says something doesn't make it false. I mean, I think what you're saying is the correct answer to that question.
Well, and it's very sad, and little side here about Nixon, because in foreign affairs, he actually was, I hate to say it, him and Henry Kissinger had a stellar team together. They actually showed an adeptness at foreign policy and diplomacy that both the Chinese and the Russians, the Soviets, really respected and have since, as we've seen, lost all respect for the State Department. But
here's what I want you to tell me about now. Let's go to 1960-61. I want you to describe the backdrop of murders and abductions by communist insurgents that's going on in South Vietnamese society. That this is kind of important for setting the stage for what happens and what's going on there.
Absolutely. Well, we were just about that point when I diverted to the 56, but here we go. The issue that was going on was, as I said, the communists had at their big meeting in the North. They said, look, the South is solidifying. It's going to be a non-communist nation. We have to do something now. And so they did. They basically reactivated their many, many cadres who stayed behind in South Vietnam. It was not, remember, I know one of the popular stories on the left is that the insurgency was one that was kicked off because of Diem's brutal rule, which was just a total lie, to be blunt. What had really happened was, of course, the communists had a very thoroughgoing infrastructure cadre of Viet Minh who were to become Viet Cong in the South. And of course, they already had supply lines through Laos. And we know we have the documents that show that even at that time, they were starting to move massive amounts of material and men and ammunition down through Laos. Laos becomes important, as we shall see. But so they basically kicked off the insurgency, which they called, and again, you have to have a sense of smell and sense of hearing whenever the communists have something. They called it the destruction of the oppression, which was their euphemism for a terror campaign in order to restrict and stop people from supporting the government. They would go into the local villages and they would find the chief or the school teacher or school teacher slash local health care worker. And they would parade them as an enemy of the people in front of the village. And they would routinely, and I've got pictures of this that make your stomach turn. And I've seen all the documents on it. They would slaughter the children in front of the parents, then slaughter the wife. And then eventually they'd slaughter the man in front of all, they'd call the village together in front of the whole village. And they did this usually by disemboweling and then beheading. It was very, very terrible and gruesome. So this would what this did was terrorize the people into silence. And then, of course, when the soldiers from the south would come and say, well, what happened and stuff, they couldn't get anything out of them. And it became very frustrating for even some of the soldiers. And some of them acted in a way that frustrated soldiers do act. And some acts of brutality did happen, but by and large, not many, because Diem wouldn't countenance it. So it is around this time that, along with a British advisory team, because we're coming into 1960-61, with this destruction of the oppression, i.e. the terrorization of the local Vietnamese in the villages by the communists, going on at full steam. I mean, within a space of 2 years, you have to understand they had murdered in a most terrible fashion that we just couldn't imagine. Over 20,000 government officials in the local villages. That's the kind of infrastructure they had to knock out of the way to terrorize the people. So it was very, very substantial. And especially for a not well-to-do emerging country, something to always bear in mind, that there's not a lot of educated officials and school teachers around. So when you murder them off, you're really left floundering. And Vietnam, to a certain extent, was. But nevertheless, the training and re-education of, more education of new teachers and stuff went on apace with, again, thanks to American help and aid. So they had to come up with a counterinsurgency program, and this is when they brought in the British expert panel that had been so successful in Malaya against the communists there, and it included Sir Robert Thompson. And in discussions with Bill Colby, who was then the CIA station chief, who I interviewed and knew quite well, they came up with the idea of the Strategic Hamlets program, which actually, in a short description, pretty well emulated what had gone on in Malaya and the successful destruction of the insurgency in Kenya, where I actually grew up there, so I knew a bit about what happened to the Mau Mau. Excuse me. So they started that with these strategic hamlets, which gave the people a say in their own security, and the hamlets had to elect their own head or chief, and so gave local a local democratic feel to it. And No Dinh Nu, Diem's brother, was absolutely fully engaged in this, along with the British advisory and along with, of course, the CIA. And it started to work, and it started to work magnificently, to the point that even the communists, by 1962, and we have this in Wilf Berchet, he was an Australian socialist who traveled with the Viet Cong, they admitted that 1962 was a victory year for Diem. They had so battered the Viet Cong back and the communists that they couldn't penetrate the villages. And so they started trying to target the strategic hamlets. The strategic hamlets were working so well they couldn't destroy them, so they started using the American news media more and more to, you know, make sounds about, oh, how wicked the strategic hamlets were, that they were concentration camps and all this sort of thing. But even that wasn't working. And so suddenly, lo and behold, what do we have in a country where there had been no Buddhist persecution? A Buddhist crisis out of nowhere, from men who other Buddhists said weren't even Buddhists, and men like Thich Trí Quang, the leader of it, who was well associated with, his brother was in the Communist Party up in the north, he was associated with the communists over in Cambodia. But that's just one side, and I won't get into that now. There's much to the Buddhist crisis that was really a red herring.
When you say red herring, that reminds me of the next thing I want to ask you, which is obviously at some point the U.S. administration sours on ZM.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons we're given is the alleged Buddhist persecution, because this was bad, you know, public relations. It made the regime look bad. It was undermining the anti-communist effort, all that stuff. But I can't believe that's the full explanation.
No, the real explanation. Well,
yeah, tell me what it was.
Has nothing to do with the Buddhists. It has to do with a failure in American diplomacy. And where this starts is with Averill Harriman, the very powerful, very influential New Dealer. I mean, he was well-recognized as a man with enormous influence in and around D.C. In fact, he'd even helped JFK in his election campaign. And therefore, even though he was becoming quite the elder statesman, they felt they had to pay him off with something after the election. And, of course, they gave him his own title of roving ambassador and then eventually whatever title he wanted in the State Department. And he had several. But what happened was that he had been, during the Second World War, he had been FDR's right-hand man with the Soviets, procuring agreements for how things would go and during the war, which he was reasonably good at, and how Europe would look after the war, which he was abysmally bad at, even though they all hailed him as the great negotiator, because, as we know, all the agreements for Eastern Europe, Stalin threw into the garbage bin. But so Harriman, here was his chance to come in and really leave the whole diplomatic field with a big win. And how he saw it, looking at Southeast Asia, along with JFK, who was scared stiff of what he saw there, was especially with the fact that they knew Laos was being used by the communists, was let's declare Laos neutral and get the Soviets, and Averill said, I can get the Soviets to make their clients, the North Vietnamese, comply. And in a famous conversation, or infamous conversation, he had with Ambassador Frederick Nolting, who was JFK's ambassador out to Vietnam, he said, I have a fingertips feeling that I can get the Soviets to make the Vietnamese communists comply with keeping Laos neutral, and they'll stay out of there. And Ambassador Nolting said to him, well, I don't have your experience with the Soviets, but my fingertips are telling me the exact opposite. And, of course, his fingertips were the correct ones. The Soviets were only too well to were only too happy to be given this position of enormous prestige in the negotiations of Southeast Asia. So they said, yes, of course, we can get them to comply. Well, there was no compliance from the North. But Averill, and so really, the path that Lau, who were an NVA or North Vietnamese construction, you know, that they were a communist force in Laos, just expanded, and so did the trail system and supply system to the south. So what happened then was, of course, the Vietnamese and even the people from Thailand, everybody in the region was squawking, you cannot make Laos neutral. Harriman had to go out, and he went out in 1961, and he, with the new ambassador, Frederick Nolting, out there. And he started to, he had a meeting with Ngo Dinh Diem about Laotian neutrality, because Diem and Ngo had been adamant that you couldn't have Laos neutral. That would be surrendering South Vietnam to constant attack on its flank. You'd be constantly on the defensive, the strategic defensive. And it couldn't bode well for the future. Harriman clashed with Diem immediately, apparently from eyewitnesses, and Nolting was one of them. They said there was a sort of a visceral dislike that was taken one for the other before they even began talking. There was a clash of a very worldly man, Averill Harriman, with a very unworldly man, Ngo Dinh Diem. That meeting didn't go well with it at the end, with Harriman basically outright threatening Diem that if he didn't comply, the U.S. would pull away all support. And of course, that would be the economic collapse of South Vietnam, not the military collapse, but certainly the economic, which would lead to the military collapse. So Diem was silent on this, and basically Ambassador Nolting, after that point, had to try and get South Vietnamese compliance, even though he agreed with South Vietnamese. And a quick note here on Nolting had been sent out by Kennedy to assure the South Vietnamese government of their absolute support of that government by the U.S. government, and that they would not interfere in South Vietnamese governmental practices, that they respected their autonomy as a national government. And Nolting was extremely good at that, even though when he had first gone out, he had been skeptical, too. He'd heard these words about this, or the background, about this prickly Vietnamese leader who was seemed a bit otherworldly and was could be difficult to get along with. But all that fell away after he met Siem, and they got along very well indeed. And one of the pillories in the, that you often come across on the left is that, well, Nolting was a kind of, you know, not very bright, which was an absolute, outright falsehood. The man had won scholarships to Harvard. His professor there had been none other than, the famous British mathematician and atheist. What was his name? I forget it right now. But anyways, he had done very well at Harvard, and had done very well in philosophy and up at the PhD level. So anyways, he was no dim bulb, contrary to leftist accusations. So the minute that Harriman gets back to D.C., to Washington, he starts plotting against Diem, and we have that. We have the files on that. We've got the documents. And from that point on, he started pitching the idea of looking for for having a coup and looking for another leader. And around him, he built this coterie or cadre of like-minded liberal thinkers such as John Kenneth Galbraith, who would then become ambassador of India, a bit of a star in the JFK crowd, and Mike Forrestal, and Roger Hilsman, national security advisor. So he built a very powerful team around him. But in effect, he didn't even need that, because his own prestige was so substantial that from eyewitness accounts, when they'd have White House meetings with Kennedy, it was more like Harriman telling Kennedy what was going to happen than Kennedy giving Harriman the instructions. In fact, Kennedy tended to bow out of the way when Harriman came online, although he wasn't happy entirely with what he heard from Kennedy. And towards the end of Diem's government in 63, he had Ambassador Nolting back in Washington giving him advice to the contrary. But it was from that point forward, really, that, to cut to the chase for your listeners, that that the planning was underway to get rid of Diem. It was all according to his objections to what was going to go on in Laos. And the agreements were signed in 62 over strong objections from the Vietnamese and from the Thai, from Thailand, and from others in the region. And, of course, the communists never honored it. In fact, they turned the Ho Chi Minh Trail into a freeway system just about coming down through Laos, and the supplies and men picked up even further, which, of course, threw South Vietnam onto the strategic defensive. It was so much the case that men like Bill Colby and people within the State Department who were not of the mind of Averill Harriman had a name for the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and they called it the Averill Harriman Memorial Highway.
Oh,
yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah, and that's in effect what it was. And the irony here is we had Harriman looking for this feather in his cap, this great diplomatic coup from, being roving ambassador and then an assistant secretary of state for Southeast Asia. This legacy. Well, his legacy was the Ho Chi Minh Trail. That is a fact. That is a historical fact. And the documents are all there to support that. So we then have the very wily Thich Trị Quang, leader of these radical Buddhists, who sensed the change in the American media, through the American media, the mood of the stories going back to the U.S., and he played to that.
Yeah, okay. All right, yeah. So let me jump in on this. Now, this is, again, this is another thing that's in every textbook, and we're all taught it a certain way, that we had a group of Buddhists who immolated themselves. That is, they set themselves on fire, and this was said to be in protest of the harsh, repressive, Roman Catholic-dominated regime of Diem. And it's to my shame – here I am, somebody who I make a point of telling everybody on the show day after day about how you can't just listen to what your seventh grade teacher taught you. You got to really dig a little bit deeper sometimes. And in the classroom, I taught this stuff. I taught it to people. And you are helping me do penance for this by being on the show. So tell me exactly then, there were Buddhists who burned themselves alive. That's true.
Yes.
But what exactly was the – who were these people, basically, is the real question.
Okay. Well, the radical – and they were radical Buddhists because, as other Buddhists will tell you, and indeed, Maggie Higgins, Margaret Higgins, a really good in terms of digging deep and getting out there into the countryside, U.S. reporter. She interviewed Buddhists, various Buddhists in the countryside at the time this was going on, and they were all saying, who are these guys in Wei at the Tu Dam Pagoda in Wei and the Zha Loi in Saigon? These were the only two basically radical pagodas. And they said they're not acting like Buddhists because they're getting involved in worldly politics. And Lord Buddha says not to meddle in such things, but to amend your own life first, and then you can be an example to others, but not to meddle in politics. And they couldn't understand this. And your average Buddhist and Buddhist monk in the countryside had nothing to do with the folks in the Tu Dam and Zha Loi pagodas. They wanted nothing to do with them. They said they weren't Buddhists. There was something terribly wrong there. So I'd like to underscore that point to your listeners. So what was going on was we had this leader, Thich Trí Quang, and I already said he had communist, very, very substantial communist connections. We've never found his name on the rolls in the communist pay book, but the connections were there. So what he needed, he had stirred up a number of smaller riots and actually quite a substantial riot in a way. Remembering, too, that often in their demonstration banners just before the burning of the Buddhist in Saigon, the Buddhist monk in Saigon, he would have the banners would be in Vietnamese and in English. So they were also for the American public. And, of course, he always called American reporters out to any of the demonstration events. And so he was playing the U.S. He was a very clever fellow. He was playing the U.S. To U.S. sensibilities. And, of course, this was being given a lot of time and a lot of air from both New York Times and Washington Post and AP, Associated Press. And the State Department cabal under Harriman was pretty well in league with a lot of the senior editors and then saying, yeah, push for this. And they did. And Thich Trí Quang did. And so I'll get to the burning Buddhist now so I don't forget that. The first one who burned himself to death, what was his name? Thich Trí Duc, if I remember right. He was known to Diem through his family doctor who knew him too, knew the Buddhist monk. And this fellow had done what was common in a certain minority sect in Buddhism. They would make these suicide pacts, and it wasn't had nothing to do with politics. It had to do with a way of showing your commitment to the Buddha, to Lord Buddha, that you would sacrifice yourself by fire to show total commitment to Buddha. This was frowned upon in mainstream Buddhism, but there was this small sect that had done it. And news had come through to Saigon that the fellow monk who he had had such a pact with had recently burned himself to death in China. And, of course, no one ever mentioned about that, what went on in China with the Buddhists. But anyways, he was then thought, okay, so Thich Trí Quang got a hold of this, and he started manipulating Duc and saying, okay, you've got to do it too. Your fellow, you've got to live up to your pact. Not telling him that, of course, that they were going to use him as a protest to the Americans and or against Diem. And play it on American media. Diem got a hold of this, and they actually had stood down from doing this, but then Quang got a hold of him again, and they compelled him, basically, you've got to live up to your agreement. So he burned himself alive, but Thich Trí Quang made sure that Malcolm Brown, he gave the Associated Press and all the American correspondents the place where to show up. He said something interesting will happen. Well, whenever Tik Chui Kwong said something interesting would happen, something horrible happened. Bombs went off that he'd blame the government on, or there'd be a riot. He'd blame that on the government. So something interesting happened. The famous Buddhist in the fire, and Malcolm Brown, thanks to Tik Chui Kwong, was there to catch it in all its horrible glory. The Buddhist in the flame. And, of course, Kwong and his associates were gathered around, and they were speaking through a loudspeaker. A Buddhist monk burns himself in protest against prejudice against the Buddhists from the Catholic government, CM. Well, it was an absolute farce. It was a total setup specifically and very cleverly for the American news media. And they of course, ran with it. There were other protests later, and they know in several cases fellows were drugged. Now, here's the interesting point, Tom. There were many, as far as the sect goes, and that doesn't mean huge numbers, Buddhist monks who burnt themselves to death in North Vietnam and China, and often in protest. And I doubt your listeners or any school teachers has ever heard of those.
Well, as a matter of fact, I could be wrong on this, but I could swear years ago I read that after the communists took over in 1975, there were immolations after that.
Oh, yeah.
But who would care about that? Because the communists are in charge, so nobody cares anymore.
Well, they carried on. Yes, exactly. And you're right. But Tik Chui Kwong had an enormous effect on U.S. policy up until the mid-60s, because, yes, even after Diem, there were regular burnings and protests. And whenever the government and the Americans didn't do what he wanted, which was to let all communists out of jail, that to be blunt, these protests would happen and people would burn themselves to death. So, I mean, it was so obvious, but the emotion that was running high, especially from these young reporters like David Halberstam, who eventually earned his Pulitzer Prize out of this, and Malcolm Brown and Neil Sheehan, who claimed to be, they would pillory Diem over his counterinsurgency efforts, mocking them, and they didn't know a darn thing about counterinsurgency, whereas the real experts who had defeated communist insurgency said Diem and New were doing a remarkable job. And Bill Colby was the bluntest of all. He said, look, it was a complete farce and a sideshow, the Buddhist crisis. They should have been suppressed a lot earlier. He almost castigated Diem and New for waiting so long to actually shut down on them. But again, the press, it became a game in the press. And even back stateside, Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State, told Nolting, and he said, regardless of the facts, we just can't stand any more burnings in Vietnam. And that's what he meant. It was the bad media play, and it was affecting Kennedy, too, and the whole idea that, a Catholic president was protecting another Catholic in South Vietnam in the face of Buddhist persecution. But right. Here is the kicker that no one pays any attention to, and they should. The United Nations, no friend of people like Ngo Dinh Diem, sent out a commission to study the reality or the myth or even the possibility of religious persecution in Vietnam. And they came back and said, and it's on the record, there was no religious persecution in South Vietnam, especially against the Buddhists. So this was totally ignored in the popular history. There's just so much to it. But again, I should leave some for your readers.
Yeah, that's right. I don't want them to – right, exactly. They should get it and read it. Let me tell you where I want to go now. Of course, the decision to connive at the assassination of Diem, there is a little bit of the gross naivete that seems to inform so much American foreign policy, whereby the removal of one person we dislike – yeah, will surely lead to a good outcome. I mean, it's incredible how many times they do this. But what I learned in particular, one of the other things I learned in your book, I didn't know anything about the social hierarchy in Vietnam. And I didn't realize that soldiers were so low in that hierarchy. And you even compared them to the way we would look at sanitation workers. They're doing a dirty but necessary job.
Precisely.
So when you take somebody like Diem, who was at the very top of that hierarchy, and you replace him with somebody who's at the bottom, the legitimacy is not there.
Absolutely. You said it for me. but yes, the coup plotting that began, of course, instigated by Averill Harriman and his cabal in Washington, filtered eventually to the CIA and to a fellow called Lucien Conin, who was to find some Vietnamese generals who would overthrow Diem. Now, the arrogance and naivete sort of rolled together. They didn't know, nor did they care about the Confucian order in Vietnam. And you're precisely right. At the top of the order is the scholarly gentleman, not necessarily rich. In fact, it's almost better if he's poor, but that he's a scholarly gentleman. This is why Ho Chi Minh tried to emulate that. Remember, he wasn't from that background, but he tried very hard to look like the scholarly, wise, old Vietnamese gentleman, what they called a C, I believe. Way down at the bottom of the level, as you've already identified for us, were the soldiers, the Binh. So Washington thought they were going to replace a C with the Binh and there'd be no problem. Well, we know the problems.
It's a whole string of them, one after the other, being replaced year after year.
We called it, in fact, couple years there, it wasn't even, didn't even take a year. It was the
I was going to say year after year is even making it sound too good.
It was the revolving door coup syndrome.
and of course, you could just stop and think, do you think that was good or bad for the situation in South Vietnam where they were trying to fight a communist insurgency? And so this mistake, this is where we get back to your page 18, where you have a problem that doesn't exist. Or even if it does exist, not really our issue anyway. But then now you create a problem that can't be solved. And then this leads to U.S. government decisions to get more and more and more involved that wouldn't have been necessary if this decision – so is that basically your view? None of what happened later would have been necessary.
Absolutely. They created a political vacuum by getting rid of the one man in South Vietnam who could hold it together because he had the Confucian mandate of heaven. He had the moral authority in the eyes of the Vietnamese. And even those who didn't like him, they still respected him and that authority that he had. You removed him and you put soldiers in his place. You created the ultimate political vacuum. You know, we saw what happened in Iraq. You removed Saddam and you had all kinds of, it's like taking the lid off Pandora's box. Well, similarly, in South Vietnam, where you had a good man, not a Saddam, Ho Chi Minh removed from power. Well, Pandora's box, the lid just didn't come open. You tore it apart. And there was absolute chaos and a power vacuum where literally you had almost to 1966 with Thich Trí Quang under the wing of the U.S. Ambassador there, Henry Cabot Lodge, calling the shots for what was going on, and the soldiers just throwing one after the other out the window, in not literally, but in coup after coup. It took years, and this is why the counterinsurgency immediately upon Diem's death, the whole strategic Hamlet's problem, program was abandoned, and of course the communists started rampaging across the countryside. The whole thing was falling apart like overnight. If the U.S. hadn't moved troops in to solidify that situation in 65, it would have been gone. And it would have been gone in 65. So they had to do that. They were morally committed, and it's a terrible thing. It was necessary. Now, eventually, after years of much suffering and pain, things did solidify somewhat under President Tu, who, by the way, even though he'd been in on the coup, had insisted, like General Tran Van Don, that nothing happened to Ngo Dinh Diem, that they would need him at least as a figurehead, and because of his enormous.
Now that reminds me. I mean, isn't it supposedly the fact that Kennedy himself hadn't realized that the coup would actually involve the murder of the guy? How much truth is there in that?
Well, in Kennedy's case, I think it was true, but the people who were dealing, from Harriman down to Lucien Conin, who are dealing with General Duong Van Minh, Big Minh, as they called him, because he was big for Vietnamese size, they knew that he had lost face earlier, many years earlier, under the Ngo Dinhs, because they caught him literally with his hands in the till, and Ngo wanted him jailed. But Diem, who was always a bit of a soft-hearted man, said, "Oh, let's, you know, let's get leave him with some respect. He kicked him upstairs into, but anyways, Nu had been, or sorry, ZM, getting my names mixed up here, a big Min had been nurturing a fairly substantial hatred, and I heard this from General Khan for years against them. And to make him the leader of the coup was guaranteed that he would have them murdered, because he had a personal hitman who Khan told me used to notch his victims on his pistol. And he's the one who did the terrible murder and really the gutting of Ngo Dinh Diem and Nu on that horrible day in 1963, November 2nd.
All right. One more thing I want to know is to what extent did people either in the U.S. public or in South Vietnam or in North Vietnam, to what extent did they know of U.S. involvement in the decision to go ahead with the assassination?
Well, the North knew, and in fact, the North...
So what was their reaction to that? So wait a minute, the Americans gave the green light to overthrow this guy of all people in the history of the world they could overthrow? They picked this one?
Well, amongst the communist leadership who knew Diem, all the false pretext about him being an American puppet, that all fell away, and they actually reached out to him. And so, through the French ambassador, they sent a message to Diem through Ho Chi Minh, said, look, we know you're a patriot in your own right, and if you want to have some kind of neutral agreement with us, we'll respect it, and we can trade goods north and south. But they said, our one underscoring feature to all of these negotiations is the Americans have to be out of there. And that didn't go anywhere, but they were reaching out to him. Even the French, who had earlier been ticked off at Diem, were trying to save him then. They had read the cards, and they said, look, the White House is turning on you. They told this to Nu, and Diem he queried this through Nolting, and Nolting said, and checked with JFK just before he left Vietnam, if, in fact, the support was still there, and he relayed that to Diem that it was. But, in fact, it wasn't. But Diem found it very difficult to actually turn against the Americans. He couldn't. It wasn't in his nature. But the fact is that they had turned against him, at least at the upper level. Did JFK know he would be murdered? No, I don't think JFK did, because he looked absolutely, from all accounts, he turned sort of an ashen gray when the minute he heard it, and he fled the Oval Office when he heard it. It may be a premonition of his own death, I don't know, but the eyewitness account said he was absolutely shocked and stunned. Guys like Roger Hilsman, yes, they knew. He was actually quite callous about it. And others even thought it temporarily was a good thing. They all of them, except for Roger Hilsman, including Averill Harriman, they later recanted, and they blamed each other. Ambassador Lodge blamed Harriman. Harriman blamed Lodge. It went back. This is the interesting thing. All these men who thought it was such a wonderful thing recanted. Even Halberstam out there, when the Buddhist crisis were going on, was interviewed by Maggie Higgins, and she said, well, you know, you must be very proud of all of this. Where's your objective reporting? And he said, well, look, we always have said that what we were doing was political. You know, we're against this government. And, he outright admitted that. And the thing was that they had never said that before. They'd always painted it as Diem bad. That was their objective opinion. But he basically admitted to Maggie Higgins that they weren't concerned with being objective. So the whole thing, as we've seen, became a terrible mess, and without U.S. force, it would have fallen to the communists, and that was all through the murder of Ngo Dinh Diem.
Well, I just can't get over when I don't even remember who pointed your book out to me. So if you're listening, thank you very much, because I wouldn't have found out about it myself. Although I do get the Ignatius Press catalog, so somehow it just flew right over my head. But I'm telling you, what you've done is such a skillfully executed case of the best kind of historical revisionism. There's a lot of bad revisionism out there where they take things that are true and then they screw with them. But this is something that we've long believed, and that, as I say, I myself taught in the classroom, and then I read your book and I just started hitting my head saying, oh, was I duped? I can't believe it. Anyway, I'm glad to, better to know the truth, you know, later than not to know it at all. So the book, once again, is The Lost Mandate of Heaven. We're going to be linking to it on today's show notes page, which is tomwoods.com/645. Jeffrey Shaw, thanks so much for your time today.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom. And if you ever want to talk about the internal workings of the Buddhist crisis, I'd be only too happy to.
Yeah, and the thing is that at the end of my show, there's a line in the outro about 30 minutes a day, and I think I've doubled that today, so I think this was as much as we could do, and for me to keep maintain my own credibility here.
Okay, well, one final thought, Tom, is I was in the same boat as you when I, as a military historian, when I first came across this story, you know, I just, okay, ZM, you know, corrupt South Vietnamese dictator, okay, I wanted to look at the armies, but I quickly realized the problem in South Vietnam wasn't the military, it was political. And then I had to look closer and closer at ZM, and things didn't add up. And the more I listened to the Vietnamese, the more they didn't add up. And when I listened to good, viable American sources from Bill Colby and Ambassador Nolting, you got a completely different picture. So I was in the same boat as you, so don't feel bad.
Okay, I feel somewhat better. All right, thanks again. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, that is going to do it for us. For those of you who have been telling me, I've been getting so many people telling me I've got to get Ryan Moran on the show because of a Facebook video he recently put up and some other stuff he's been up to. The wheels are in motion. I'm going to write to him. We'll get him on. So you don't have to keep writing to me. I hear you. I'll get the guy on. All right, that's it for today, everybody. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.